Hello, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thank you so much again for listening and downloading. It is a pleasure to be speaking to you. I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. You can follow me on Twitter at NJH287 and get previous episodes and more content at dsmsports.net. Really fun show today, really informative, really insightful. Someone I've been following and known for a long time, and he is one of the best in the business. We talked to Vice President of Digital Media for the Boston Celtics, Peter Stringer. You're definitely going to want to hear from him, just a ton of good information, and I learned a lot, and you will too. But before we talk to Peter, we have this episode's helpful tool. And Simple's Helpful Tool is more of a use case for a service that you probably know about. So I've been having some discussions recently about how to, you know, get easy Snapchat geo filters. There are some apps out there. My friend Karen Freeberg recommended one called Confetti, and that's for a little fee. But I found that Fiverr has a lot of good resources for Snapchat geo filters, starting, of course, at $5. So if you're not familiar with Fiverr, basically it's a place to find small and creative tasks that can be done starting at $5. So that's Fiverr, F-I-V-E-R-R, two R's, .com. And if you type in Snapchat geo filters, you'll find quite a few pretty highly rated offers for $5 geo filters. They'll take care of delivering it to Snapchat. You can get some revisions. There are, of course, some premium upsells for additional fees and additional services and sort of premium stuff that you can get. But a really good place if you don't really know where to start, or if you lack the skills or the time or just the know-how to create your own Snapchat geo filter, these guys will do it for you. And you're not going to spend more than $5 or $10. And if, again, someone to do all that creative work for you, you can tell them what you want, tell them where to place it, and basically, you know, throw down $5 or $10 and you can have your venue have a Snapchat geo filter, your next big event. So really a good opportunity to start playing around with Snapchat geo filters, even if you're not a Photoshop guru or if you know exactly how to meet Snapchat standards to get accepted. So that's it. That's the episode's helpful tool, a way to start getting started with Snapchat geo filters. Have someone else do it for $5 or $10. So check it out. Go to Fiverr, Fiverr.com, and give one a shot today. I found it to be pretty useful, and I think you will too. All right, that's the episode's helpful tool, and we will be right back to have a really in-depth, awesome conversation with Vice President of Digital Media for the Boston Celtics, Peter Stringer. All right, that was this episode's helpful tool, and now we are delighted to be joined by one of the best in the biz when it comes to digital and social and sports. Our guest today is Vice President of Digital Media for the Boston Celtics, Peter Stringer. Thanks so much for joining the podcast, Peter.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Great to be talking to you with the NBA season getting closer by the day. It just seems like just yesterday that the finals were happening. But we're going to have a great discussion about all things digital and social with the Celtics and beyond. Peter is a wealth of knowledge. But first, let's hear about where you came from. Tell us about your career path, how you got started in the business, and how you got to where you are today.
Wow, I mean, think about the journey and whatnot. It's been a long time. I went to school for journalism at Boston University here. Grew up in New Hampshire, about an hour north. Went to BU, and kind of the plan going into BU really was to be the beat writer for the Boston Celtics. That was kind of what I had in my head, And at that time, really never thought about the fact that you could actually work for the team. That was not really something I was just cognizant of. But in any event, during journalism school, ended up coming up with an internship at New England Sports Network my junior year with some help of a
Nesson for our listeners.
That's right, yeah, Nesson. If you're familiar with that, obviously they're the TV outlet that covers the Bruins and the Red Sox. And at that time, and this is I'm dating myself, but this is mid to late 90s, and they were launching a sports content website, which, you know, sounds like something that you'd be doing 20 years later. And really it was kind of way ahead of its time in terms of a concept. And Nesson.com site today, nothing like what it was when I was there. But nonetheless, that internship really got me started in the business. And when I got there, you know, my background obviously was in writing, and so I wanted to write as much content as possible. So I was writing stuff on the Bruins and the Red Sox and the Patriots and the Celtics. But really, my passion was always basketball, and so at that point, we were just, you know, putting together short writing written pieces about the games, and, you know, we weren't actually covering the games. And I said, look, you know, I'd love to go and cover the games at the Garden. Let me call up the PR people over there and see if I can get a credential. And so the Bruins had credentialed me, the Red Sox had credentialed me. That was pretty easy given the Nesson relationship. But the Celtics, I had to talk them into it a little bit, and the Patriots, you know, the Patriots weren't the juggernaut that they are now. This is the Bledsoe Patriots and not the the Brady Patriots at that point. But anyway, so started covering both Pats games and Celtics games as well as Red Sox and Bruins kind of year-round, and kind of just worked my way into being around the media every day and writing stuff for Nesson's website and opinion pieces and all sorts of stuff. And you know, got to know the guys who are in many cases still covering the team to this day, and kind of working alongside the media, and kind of quickly realized a few things. And one was that I didn't want to be a beat writer anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, having seen the lifestyle for the beat writers, and you know, traveling commercial, and you know, just seeing it up close and what they had to do every day
it's a grind.
It's a complete grind. And those guys, I mean, you know, we've got a few guys here who've been on the beat for a while in Boston, covering different teams for many, many years. And you know, you have to respect the time, energy, and effort that they put into it. But it's also, you know, putting all that aside, it doesn't really make for you know, a lot of personal time. And so seeing that early on, I kind of felt like, yeah, you know what, the beat writer thing sounded like a good idea. But I also wasn't willing to do, you know, to be frank, I didn't want to do the thing where you go and work at a small paper in Wheeling, West Virginia, and cover high school sports, and then work your way to Cincinnati, and then hopefully from Cincinnati, maybe you get to Albany, and then from Albany, you get to Boston, and you know, burn 10 years of your career trying to get to a big major paper. I just didn't see that as being a desirable path for myself, and you know, whether you call it paying your dues or whatever you want to call it, at that point I was already working alongside the media every night and going to the games and doing what they were doing in Boston. So to me, it was, you know, it was crazy to think, well, why would I just want to start over? And at the same time, obviously the website era was beginning, and so having taught myself, you know, the technology behind building websites and HTML and CSS and Photoshop and all those things.
You just sort of glossed over the fact that you taught yourself all these skills just kind of in your spare time while at Nesson, or what?
Yeah, no, well, that was the job. The job was really to you know, basically it was an internship to run the website, and really the writing part was secondary. So yeah, I had an internship before that at a PR firm in Boston, and the guy sitting next to me, who's one of my best friends to this day, was building websites for them. And he was a Harvard kid, and you know, so I was like, oh, well, it must be, you know, really tough stuff if the Harvard guy's doing it. But you know, he's like, hey, take this book and, you know, take it home. And he was running a server out of his dorm in Harvard, which not exactly Facebook at that time, but you know, Harvard was kind of a different environment than BU was with regard to technology. And so in any event, I learned to publish websites in my spare time, basically, when I was interning that summer at the Weber Group in Cambridge, which is a PR firm. And so anyway, that set me up to get that Nesson internship. And anyway, as I moved forward from that, my career kind of went down the website development path. After interning at Nesson, my boss had gone to Fidelity Investments to run a website group there. Basically doubled my salary going to financial services out of sports, which I think that was the other thing too, you know, working in sports, especially right out of school or coming off an internship, you're going to get paid nothing. And that's industry wide. That's not just, you know, that wasn't Nesson. That wasn't just specific to that company. You know, ask anybody who's worked in the industry, they'll tell you that.
Oh yeah.
You know, whether that's a good thing or not is a different story altogether, but nonetheless, so having made the jump to financial services and kind of learning about, you know, really website development in a public professional environment, in a corporate environment, so to speak, you know, was a little bit eye-opening too. And so I spent a lot of time doing website consulting after that, some independent stuff, and then, you know, working on a project basis for a bunch of different places before the Celtics job ended up coming up in 2005. And at that point, I had still always kind of kept my toes in the water, so to speak. I had freelanced even after I left Nesson full time. When I was working at Fidelity, I was still going nights and weekends to Bruins and Celtics games mostly. Did some work for BostonBruins.com, a little bit of stuff for RedSox.com, and a few other things on a freelance basis. So I kind of always – there was only really about a year in my career where I wasn't somehow involved with sports. Mm-hmm. but along the, you know, along that time, kind of always felt like, you know, my best skill was still writing. And so I spent a lot of time just trying to write there. I think I wrote for like hoopsworld.com or a couple basketball publications as well for a little while. And so always kind of kept a foot in the door with regard to the industry. And so when the job came open in 2005, Jeff Twist, who's still with us here at the Celtics as our PR, and you know, was hired by Red Auerbach back. That's how far back he goes. You know, he was able to get my resume in, and I was actually hired by Daryl Morey, who's now the GM at the Houston Rockets, but he was the I believe the COO, I believe, at the time for the Celtics, kind of running operations here, so that was interesting. He left shortly after to get that Rockets job, which is obviously, you know, in terms of the NBA, kind of a watershed moment in terms of the analytics movement. Totally. You know, I'm not a numbers guy, so to speak, but I always just found that interesting that, you know, as soon as he hired me, he kind of moved on and got that job. It kind of blew everybody away. It was a different time back then, obviously. The NBA is very much an analytics-driven league now, too. But so, yeah, that's kind of the journey, a really long way of kind of spelling. Kind of how I got to who I am. And then, you know, when I started, it was, here's one person to run the website. And I came to the Celtics and said, look, you know, we don't have any content on this website. And I was somebody who was going to a lot of Celtics games on my own, not even just covering them, but I would occasionally go as a fan. And said, you know, listen, I've never been to Celtics.com, and I don't have any reason to go there. If we want fans to come there, we need to have content. And this is back in 2005. And so I started, as part of my job with the Celtics, following the team around and going to practices and covering the games as if I was right alongside the media, because I had done that before, and that's what I knew. And I knew I could bring a lot of value in terms of written coverage of the team. And so, you know, it was funny at that time, like, and this is a little bit, this is still pre-Twitter, but, you know, I would go to practice and write a recap and put it up on the website that afternoon. And in 2006, people weren't doing that. That was, newspapers were definitely not doing that. The beat writers would go to practice. They'd write their story. It'd be in the can, you know, but they could spend their whole afternoon writing the stuff because they knew it wasn't going to come out till the next day. But things started to change when people like myself and some of the sports blogs would start picking up on the fact that, hey, you know what, the Celtics website has an update from practice, and the Globe and the Herald didn't have anything until the next morning. And that eventually started changing. Not to say that I was responsible for that, but I think there were a lot of teams that kind of started going down that path, and it forced the industry to kind of shift. And then obviously Twitter really, you know, exploded everything, and then you had to be kind of up to the minute. But it was a different time when I first started, for sure. The emphasis was completely different. Certainly video was nothing that a team was doing at that point. We didn't start doing video until the end of our 2008 season, the year we won the title. And I still have, it's funny, I still have cassette, like video, HD video cassettes laying around. You know, from the locker room when we won it, and it's, you know, I've got Scalabrine dumping champagne on my head and all sorts of stuff that, you know, it's hilarious to go think back to kind of where we are. And you know, so kind of started that with dragging an intern around, you know, interviewing players myself. And now I've got a staff of seven people who are creating content pretty much around the clock, and three full-time video editors. We have a couple full-time reporters who, you know, report on the team with much better on-camera aesthetics than I could ever have provided back in my day. And so it's a much different operation than it was when I walked in the door in 2005.
And was there like was there always support early on, or was there sort of a moment when all of a sudden the execs and your bosses realized, you know, if you build it, they will come. If we have good content, if we have content period on our website, that we can attract traffic, and, you know, and there is value to that as well.
Yeah, you know, I think early on, I don't think people got it right away. But certainly, I had a lot of support internally, certainly from our CMO, Sean Sullivan, and our president, Rich Gotham, who, Rich comes from the world of Lycos and, you know, internet. So he understands, online and digital better than most team presidents would. And then, Sean Sullivan has been here, I'm going to say over 20 years. He was here when Rick Pitino was here. That's how long he's been here. But certainly passionate about the team, and always wanted to read about what we were doing. And so to have us creating content directly about what the team was up to at practice and the games, I think, you know, he saw the value very quickly and was very supportive of it. And, you know, to this day, like I said, we're cranking out a ton of content, and not just content for the sake of content, but very high value content that our partners can get involved with. You know, I'll put our production values in terms of the video content we produce up against any pro team in the league that's doing it, you know, with a digital group and not with their regional cable sports provider. You know, we are not, the content that we create for our website and Facebook and Twitter and all those platforms is all created in house. It's not done by our regional sports affiliate, Comcast Sportsnet. And so, you know, there are some teams that have a very symbiotic relationship with those the RSNs, and we have a great relationship with RSN, but we're not at the end that we put out online.
And what was there kind of a moment early on, or even now, are you guys really competing with the Boston Globes, the CSNs of the world, or are you trying to do your own thing and be a unique place for content for the Celtics?
Well, you know, here's what I would say about that. I think that, you know, the Facebook really changed a ton of things for teams in this space, because where it used to be the Boston Herald and Boston Globe had all the distribution, when it comes to the way people consume content now, which is largely through social, when we've got 9 million fans on Facebook, we can get content in front of people that the Globe will never reach in terms of numbers, in terms of just, you know, following and having that opportunity. And it was even more dramatic a few years ago, before Facebook really started cranking down on the algorithms and kind of de-emphasizing branded content and sports team content versus just your friends and family and cat pictures and all the stuff that they think they want to show you now. We had a much larger source of distribution content than either one of the local papers had for quite a while, and that continues. That said, you know, certainly the resources that we've spent and time and energy we've put in and staffing we've put into content, you know, we are in some ways, I would say, competitive from the standpoint of size and energy that our own TV affiliate is. You know, the Globe and Herald has that. We've got somebody on the road. We've got a team of three people on the road with us everywhere we go now for the last couple of years. And so we've got a reporter, a writer, and a videographer on the road following the team everywhere. You know, if anything, where it used to be many of the papers, even like the smaller regional papers, would travel to cover the team, now it's really just the Herald, the Globe, Comcast Sportsnet, and I want to say maybe one other publication, ESPN Boston, will send a reporter on the road, but not necessarily everywhere. And some of the other smaller papers may send them to select games. But if you want coverage of every single game, there's only a few places to get it. And I think, you know, from a video standpoint, we're certainly providing the best.
And when it comes to, I mean, maybe this has changed over time as well from when you started, I'm almost certain it has. What are the metrics? What are the KPIs? What's the business case, and you know, that you guys are able to convey to the upper part of the organization, especially, you know, when you start from just yourself being a one man show to now having a big team creating content? What's been the way to justify this does have value to the Celtics?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, really the concept has been that resources would follow revenue. And so for us, you know, the monetization model has been creating high quality content that our partners could be associated with and put their branding on. And obviously Facebook has done a lot of work in the recent months to try to curtail that and control it more drastically, because obviously they want a piece of that pie now. Not surprisingly, they're pretty sophisticated about this stuff, but yeah. So in our case, you know, we've got the Amtrak travel report. We had the Amex home court advantage pregame show, live streaming pregame show, Optum practice report. Putnam is a huge partner of ours, and they've got several branded pieces of content. So all of kind of the table stakes content that we produce has a corporate partner behind it that as part of their arrangement with us and their deal. There's a carve out for digital content. And so, you know, my group is definitely turning a profit because of that. And so, the model works really well. You know, I think the challenge becomes, as you continue to bring on more and more partners, is finding distribution for all this content. And I think a lot of teams are in this space now where it's like, well, you can only put out so much stuff to Facebook before your reach starts dropping on specific videos. And so, you know, it's an interesting time now in terms of, you know, a couple of years ago, when you were reaching 50% of your Facebook audience, and we had 3-4 million fans at that point, you know, we were getting in some ways much bigger audiences for our content than we are now. But the model basically works, and I would say that, you know, it certainly works from a financial standpoint. I think we're kind of at that inflection point where Facebook is continuing to change on a very rapid basis, and sometimes you have to be cognizant of the fact that what works today may not work tomorrow, and you kind of have to be able to read the tea leaves a little bit and follow the industry and make sure you're staying up to speed on what the platforms are doing and kind of how they're enforcing their own rules and kind of, you know, what's likely to come next. And that's something I spend a lot of time on.
I think early on, you know, the Celtics in particular, have done so, as you just described too, that have done so well with monetizing their content and getting partners to buy in, and that just doesn't happen by itself. I mean, that means educating the corporate sales team on how to convey that value, how to sell that stuff. It's not part of their rate card, so to speak. And what's that process been like in working with those guys and helping them figure out this does have value? Here's how to convey it. Here's some ways to think about, you know, showing the value and pricing it.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I would say it was very much an education process. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, we had some knockdown, drag out fights about, you know, digital assets being thrown into deals and not being, measured, that type of thing. We're well past that day now. I'm sure there are probably still some teams that still deal with that stuff. I won't name names, but I happen to know there's a few teams in the NBA itself that have partnership teams that just don't understand this concept. And so, you know, now for us, everything that we do from a digital content standpoint is built with the idea that a partner could be a part of it and hence be monetized. In terms of the rate card, that's something that I spend a lot of time with my colleagues here who work on the partnership sides to look at, what that value is. And obviously, you can argue about what the value of a Facebook fan is or a video view is, and you have to come up with some sort of basis to start charging against your content. We've got a number that we think a video view is worth on Facebook for branded content, and we use that number to then extrapolate across the amount of views we expect a campaign or a platform to generate over the course of a season. And that allows us to basically back into a media value for the campaign, and then based on that value, obviously, nobody's paying a rack rate completely for something like that when you're a partner that has a bunch of different assets across TV, arena, and everything else. But, really, that's the basic methodology for how we've developed our rate card. And our rate card isn't something that, we're not hanging it on the wall at the office for our partners to see and kind of – it's not an a la carte kind of business, but, you're not buying videos by the view. But at the same time, it allows us to come up with real-world values for the content that we're creating. And I would say that, some of our content is probably dramatically underpriced. I'm not afraid to say that. I think the challenge is sometimes demonstrating that to the partner. Every partner is different. Some partners are incredibly sophisticated about this stuff. Some of them have multiple agency partners that have a lot of in-house intelligence on it. Some of them really do look to us for more guidance on this space. And so there's a little bit of a mix of everything. And we try to be as transparent as possible about it. But certainly the I'd say that it's more science than it used to be. It used to be a lot more art. In terms of kind of rate carding this stuff, I think we're getting better all the time about figuring out what a realistic value is for this stuff. And again, a lot of that really depends on Facebook and their algorithm and kind of what their, what kind of reach you can expect on your content. Because, you have the best content in the world, but without distribution, it's meaningless. And I think that's, again, kind of what we're always kind of trying to figure out and determine maintain is how much distribution can we give to our content. And, if our fans don't see it, it's not worth anything to anybody.
Yeah, as I guess NBC Olympics is learning that now, where they have to plan some make goods when their TV viewership numbers don't meet what the contract stipulated.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about the Olympics now is that the main story about the Olympics coverage this year has been the streaming numbers.
Oh, totally.
Which if you go back to 2004, the main story about the Olympics was HDTV, which tells you everything you need to know, right? It was about – in 2004, it was like, wow, people are watching the Olympics on these brand new HDTVs that are 70 inches wide. And now it's about streaming that people are probably watching on a four-inch telephone or a 10-inch iPad, and in some case streaming over the top to their providers, whether it's through Apple TV or whatever it may be. So it's a much different world than it used to be just 10 years ago or 12 years ago in that case.
I think you nailed it earlier too, or swished it or slam dunk, however you want to call it, with a basketball analogy, with really breaking it down into a science of valuing those digital assets. And Yeah, Amex, I'm sure the only thing they're paying for is not your your pregame show. You know, it's obviously part of a bigger agreement, of course, so it's not like a line item on their contract, but allows you to sort of give a value to that asset on its own and build that into the agreement. So it's not necessarily paying on a CPM per view basis, but at least it shows here's where that number came from. And I think that's a kudos to you to you know, educate them on that process and build that in. So it's cool to hear.
Well, and I would say for as big as the social followings are for the NBA in terms of things like website traffic, those types of things, we are not the NFL. And the NFL is by far the biggest player in the game. And it's not even close for the other leagues. The NFL is probably in a position where they can probably sell on a CPM basis. Every other sports league is not in that spot. There's just not enough organic traffic to the team destination sites. The league site as a whole, maybe, but certainly for most of the teams, they're not in a position to be able to crank out enough page views to be able to sell on that type of a basis. So for us, it's certainly, listen, we're calculating in terms of trying to figure out what our audience looks like and what that value is, and then trying to come up with a formula to figure out exactly what that means to our partners in terms of what's that expected media value they can expect to receive. And you know, we take a percentage of that.
Having a great chat with Peter Stringer, Vice President of Digital Media for the Boston Celtics. Let's go back real quick to the league itself. You talked about the NBA versus NFL. How much does the league sort of step in and help you guys maximize the value of your content and showcase that value and educate you guys? Or is it more, you know, every club on their own with some collaboration here and there?
Well, I would say the league's model has always been, and they've said this, since the David Stern era when I started, obviously, and now Adam Silver, who's very in touch with what's going on in the digital landscape, even more so than his predecessor, to his credit. The league is certainly on top of this, and there's no shortage of stories talking about how progressive the league has been in digital and social specifically. But certainly when we get together as a league in January at our annual marketing meetings down in Miami, digital is always a very big topic. Normally, and then in the summertime as well, we traditionally have gotten together in Vegas around Summer League, and this year we actually the digital groups at the teams got together in Austin. In June, right before the finals, I believe it was. And again, this stuff changes so quickly that, you know, even though we meet as a league probably twice a year, I always feel like that's not enough and that we probably should meet three or four times a year or quarterly, because again, what's true today for Facebook or for Twitter or for Instagram, you know, give it 2 weeks and it's not the same anymore. And so it really, it's something the league obviously spends a lot of time and energy on. There's a lot of people at the league and very smart people who are paying attention to these trends. But, you know, I've always found that it's always been a handful of teams at the NBA, and I like to include ourselves in that mix, that are really dialed into this stuff and really try to help the league set the direction on this stuff, and, you know, are not afraid to kind of go to battle and you know, make our opinions known with regard to what the league should and shouldn't be doing in the digital space and some of the rules and regulations that we do have to play by. You know, it's certainly not MLB where everything is centralized on digital and the kind of the league hands down, you know, very specific rules on what they can and can't do and really owns most of the opportunity in digital. So we didn't go to that model that the MLB went to about, what, 15 years ago, something like that. But the league still is very important in terms of kind of setting the directions and the overall guidelines that we have to play by with regard to things like streaming on social and some of the newer things as they come up. I think, you know, the challenge for us to stay on top of this stuff and to be on the cutting edge is to do that without bending the rules too much with regard to what the league is asking us to do and not do.
No, especially with the Periscope and Facebook Live growing these days, I'm sure that those questions are more important than ever.
Well, absolutely, especially when you've got TV partners spending billions of dollars to broadcast your games. It certainly makes sense. I think, you know, the interesting thing is going to be now is that, you know, if you look at Facebook Live, I mean, if you stoke up a live stream on Facebook, you get a pretty large audience right away, and we'd love to have that audience. And right now, that's something that we're not really allowed to do with regard to anything beyond a press conference. I'd love to be able to stream a pregame show through Facebook directly to our fans. fans. There's a lot of things I would love to be able to do with that platform that we currently are not allowed to do. And I think, you know, those rules are going to continue to evolve as, you know, there's always some lawyers involved and there's a lot of other things at stake beyond just kind of what the digital guy at a team wants to do for good reason. And I'm sure the league will be happy to hear me say that, but which I have. But at the same time, you know, it's my job to continue to push them on things like this and feel like, you know, these are things that are important to the team and here's why they're important. And obviously, you know, there's a bigger picture sometimes that that dwarfs what a team may want to do. But again, I look at it as my responsibility heading up this space for the Celtics to continue to push the league on these types of things and make sure that, you know, we're attacking it in the smartest way possible.
Yeah, I mean, those agreements, those league rules, that infrastructure, it's always going to be outpaced, it seems like, by technology and new platforms. And so it's just a matter of just catching up, I guess, and having folks like you to make sure that the league is aware that these are issues that need to evolve and you know, catch up to where technology is going.
You bet.
But I want to shift gears to something I know is has been close to your heart over the years, and that's really, you know, representing the Celtics on social in front of all those millions of fans. And, you know, we've seen probably going back now with 5-6 years when the LA Kings made it cool to be sort of sound like a schoolyard bully on social media, the sarcastic nature of sports, and the Sixers and in the NBA world. I guess tell me a long way of saying, tell me about the Celtics brand that they want to portray on social and how that varies from how like the Kings do it when they want to inject that more, I guess, haughty personality or caustic personality.
Yeah, you know, it's something that I will say that the personality or better yet, the lack thereof personality on our Twitter feed has been something that I won't lie, comes from me. And I think because I look at what the Celtics brand is, and how it should be represented. And to me, the Celtics are not snarky. The Celtics are 17-time world champions, steeped in 70 years of history, from Red Auerbach to Bill Russell to Larry Bird, you know, you name it, Paul Pierce, all these guys, Garnett. And, you know, they put blood, sweat, and tears on the line. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what the Celtics brand is. It's not something that I think is funny in the moment, and is snarky in the moment or taking a shot at another team in a public forum just because it might get you a couple of retweets. That's always been my outlook and mentality because that's what our brand is. And, you know, I grew up watching this brand since I was a kid. And so to me, our online presence needs to reflect what our brand is. And I think, you know, it's funny that Complex Sports article came out this summer, which I think was written by a kid that used to run the Sixers Twitter account or something, and then a few other people.
Yeah.
And the Sixers, I think, went down that same path. And I think so, certainly, you know, from that type of stuff, you know, to me, I took that thing with a grain of salt in the sense that, you know, it's obviously a subjective ranking, number one, in terms of, you know, they basically said, oh, well, you know, they're not having fun with their Twitter feed. And, well, you know, that's fine, but that's just not our philosophy on how we do it. And at the league meetings in Austin, you know, we sat around and talked about that article a lot, not because I necessarily wanted to talk about it, but other teams wanted to talk about it. And, you know, it was funny, like the Portland Trailblazers in that meeting were saying, hey, you know, we know we're not going to, like, take a shot at the Celtics because they're not going to respond anyway, and that's just not what they do. And it's not what they are. And so I think some of the teams in the room got it and understand that. I think that, you know, it's like anything else. You know, some brands don't have anything to lose. Some brands, you know, when you don't have that type of history, you can be a lot more quick and loose with kind of how you portray yourself. But even in that situation, I don't really think I would take that approach. You know, to me, we should be echoing what Brad Stevens wants to put out, what Danny Ainge wants to put out, what our players are talking about. Like, to me, we should be amplifying and echoing what those guys are all about. And to me, you know, the way that the Celtics conduct themselves and the way Brad Stevens conducts themselves, none of that would fit in with the type of stuff that that Complex Magazine was celebrating in that article. And this is not, you know, I'm not taking a shot at those guys or the writer or anything like that. It's simply just that, you know, what they were evaluating the Twitter feeds on was something completely different than the way we look at the platform. And that's all there really is to it. And so, you know, could we be more fun on Twitter? Maybe occasionally. But realistically, I just don't look at it that way. It's, you know, to me, you're representing the brand every time you tweet. And so I just always felt like, you know, and again, there's a few other people that have their hands in Twitter for us, you know, beyond myself. And if anything, I have less of hand in it now than I used to. But, you know, realistically, it's always been about we don't want to screw up what all these people have built with their blood, sweat, and tears mm-hmm. and what that brand means to so many people and generations of fans. And because, you know, what's the point? Why would you do that? And so that's always been the approach for mine. You know, who knows? We could change that down the line as more people get involved and really have strong opinions on it. And, so, you know, even the brand itself is something that I felt we needed to kind of hash through and rethink kind of, all right, well, what does the Celtics brand mean to people now that, you know, maybe it's different than it did mean to me as a kid, as a five-year-old kid watching the games on my dad's lap when Larry Bird and McHale and Parrish and all those guys were playing. You know, sometimes you do have to rethink these things. But I think ultimately, if it doesn't match your brand, then you shouldn't be doing it. And I think that's kind of where I've always felt that's where I've always kind of come out on it.
No, very thoughtful, very well put. And I think it definitely goes – it's definitely a strong sentiment to say that the personality on Twitter or the brand that you're putting out on social media, the brand of the organization trumps that completely. And, you know, that's where you don't want the Celtics to be known for something that the Celtics aren't known for, just their Celtics Twitter feed is known for, let alone having, you know, Coach Stevens having to answer about a snarky tweet calling out an opposing player or something like that as well.
Absolutely. You know, that would be my worst nightmare is for some reason we did something stupid on Twitter and now Brad's got to answer for that, which he had nothing to do with, or Danny has to answer to it, or one of our players. Listen, these guys work so hard to create an environment with no distractions. I don't want to ever be responsible for being a distraction for them. They work way too hard. I respect it way too much. I've gotten the privilege to see it up close a lot, having had the chance to travel with those guys, you know, both with when Doc Rivers was here and then certainly with Brad as well occasionally. And yeah, to me, there's no upside. I mean, even if you get 10,000 retweets, then what? What does that mean? Does it help you sell more tickets? Does it help you sell more merchandise? Does it meet any of the bottom line goals that we have as an organization, as a company? I don't really think so. And so that's really how I have always looked at it, and will continue to look at it.
I love it. Well, let's a couple more minutes left with Peter Stringer, VP Digital Media for the Boston Celtics. Tell me about you know, being in the city of Boston, where there's so much just passion for the sports teams. You think about the Celtics and their strong brand, but then you think about the Red Sox and their strong devotion and their community, and then the Bruins and the Patriots, you know, obviously as well. So how do the Celtics kind of find their way to stand out among that crowd and have fans that continue to devote themselves to the Celtics, maybe as their number one, or at least, you know, in their hearts?
Well, I would say, obviously, you know, for us, certainly we are fortunate, again, to have that history of 17 world championships and, you know, all the iconic players who've played here. And certainly that helps. And, you know, I'd put that legacy up against any of the other teams in town from that standpoint. But, you know, we're fortunate to be in a place where, first of all, our fans are passionate. It's a pro sports town. You know, it's funny. I always tell people I don't really follow college basketball very much because college basketball is just not a big thing here. People in the Northeast are pro sports fans, and so, you know, people follow the Celtics and the Patriots and the Red Sox and the Bruins, but, you know, the college teams here, unfortunately, outside of college hockey, kind of has a niche following here.
Oh, yeah, the Beanpot.
Yeah, I mean, the Beanpot's fantastic. I went to BU, obviously. We called it the BU Invitational when I was there, and probably still do, but yeah, certainly we're fortunate to be in an environment like that, and you know, the whole the old rising tide lifts all boats I think is very applicable here. And you know, there's a ton of crossover between fans who come to Bruins games and come to Celtics games. And you know, I was at the Red Sox game on Sunday. I always make it a point to get to a couple road games for the Pats every year, and get down to Gillette once or twice a season, and you know, playoff games and that type of thing. And you know, listen, if you grew up here, you're kind of brainwashed into it. It's much like a great sports town like Chicago or St. Louis, you know, New York, certainly, Philly, all those places are great sports towns, and we're no exception to that. I like to think we're the best, but you know, regardless, I think it's nothing but positive for us.
So is it less about, you know, usurping the front page of the sports section and more just, you know, being part of the general sports conversation that's happening on a daily basis?
I mean, listen, we'd love to be the top story headline all the time, you know, but you have to be realistic about the fact that, you know, well, I guess a good example of that would be that we typically always play a game on Super Bowl Sunday, but we always play it at 1 o'clock, and there's a reason for that, because we know there's a very good chance that the Pats are likely to be involved. In fact, yeah, so this year we're playing the Clippers at 2 p.m. on Friday, I'm sorry, Sunday, February 5th, and that's not an accident.
Ah, gotcha. Last one for you, Peter. You guys obviously had a new coach hired not that long ago. He's done pretty well so far in his time there, but you know, the first time for Coach Stevens coming from Butler. So, what was that like from a digital and social perspective? Were you guys really working closely to frame the story, to introduce the culture, and how much did Brad Stevens sort of have his hand in that as well?
Well, I think, you know, actually the cool part about that was when we hired Brad Stevens, nobody saw it coming. You know, Danny had apparently
kept it under wraps. I don't know how.
We did. And I can tell you this, the secret to that is actually it's kind of one of those things where it makes a ton of sense when you hear kind of how it happened. But, you know, we got word of it internally, and it was pretty clear that the story was not going to get out. And the reason it wasn't going to get out is because, let's just say Brad's agent is not in the typical agent pool in terms of NBA agents. I don't believe his agent represents anyone else. And so from that standpoint, it wasn't, you know, typically NBA stories got broken by agents, right? So when players get traded or signed, 9 times out of 10, the story gets out because an agent leaks it to a reporter, or somebody maybe at the league office leaks a story to a reporter. Right. In this case, we didn't have that phenomenon in play. And so that allowed us to really keep the story in-house and then break it actually on our Twitter feed, which was pretty amazing. That's probably the only time that'll ever happen again, to be frank. A story of that nature to be able to be broken on the team's actual feed. So many people have asked me about that, especially when it happened right away, because people were blown away by the fact that we were able to kind of break that story without any of the, you know, big time, you know, the Wojnarowskis of the world who kind of, you know, who's tweeting out draft picks before they even come out and that kind of stuff. That's the world we live in now with the NBA and all sports generally, but especially the NBA. And yeah, so to be able to get that story out on our own feed and kind of blow the world away with it, and you know, that was a pretty awesome moment for us internally, just because we kind of knew it was so rare and unlikely to happen again.
Well, yeah, I mean, what a cool opportunity too. I mean, usually that stuff gets leaked out, you know, hours or days in advance, and you have ESPN segments, you have columns being written, and people sort of framing the story. And you guys were able to really seize that right off the top, and you know, own the story kind of.
Yeah, you know, and actually the funny part about that, I remember that day and the days leading up to it, basically searching Twitter, looking for Brad Stevens Celtics, Brad Stevens, and found like two or three random tweets by people with no followings or very small followings. And obviously, as we know, it only takes like a couple of retweets for that to end up in the hands of somebody who could actually really broadcast it. But I believe, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was, but I think somebody had like seen Danny Ainge and Brad in a restaurant or somewhere in Indiana and tweeted about it and speculated that Brad Stevens was going to be the next coach. And I wish I still had the link to the tweet, but I remember coming across something like that and being like, ah, shit, this is definitely going to get out. And, you know, it didn't end up happening, thankfully. And so I was like, all right, you know, we made it through. So that was that was pretty crazy though, as we, you know, certainly I was continuously looking to see if the story would leak out and break, and we managed to not have any leaks. So it was a pretty cool moment for the guy that was running digital.
What a cool story. What a fun story. I could really we barely touched on all the things I wanted to talk about today, but just so much good stuff in this conversation, and we're gonna have a little more fun with Peter coming up in our pulling the string segment. But first, we have this episode's charitable stat coming at you right now. Really, really good conversation with Peter Stringer, VP of Digital Media for the Boston Celtics. Just, I'm not lying when I said I had a ton more notes that we could have discussed. Just chock full of experience, and really love picking his brain. But we'll have a little more fun, Peter, coming up in our pull on the string segment. Some fun, quick hitting questions and a little more knowledge dropped as well. But first, we have this episode's shareable stat. This episode's shareable stat comes from the Rio Olympics, specifically the fastest man in the world, Usain Bolt. And it's looking at the tweet he sent mere seconds, it seemed like, after he won the 100-meter race and reclaimed or kept his title as fastest man in the world once again. That tweet came out maybe a minute after after he crossed the finish line, won gold once again, and it racked up 68,000 tweets as I speak to you now in just a handful of days after the race was won. If you look at how it compares to his other tweets, most top out around 8,000 or 9,000 with gold medals. Usually they're more in the 1,000 range. So 68,000 is quite a big jump, including over 40,000 retweets in the first 10 to 15 minutes. But what can we learn from that in the social media and sports space? Well, it's to be prepared that timing matters. Sure, he could have waited until he did an interview or did his victory lap and then had his team send that tweet or sent it himself. But he was ready. The timing was right, and he was able to get it when everyone was excited, when people's timelines were blowing up. And to see Usain Bolt go across the board and have every media publication retweet you, and everyone who's on Twitter watching this race on a global scale sitting there together was going to retweet you. And what did the tweet say? It said, "Thank you, Jamaica." So maybe it would have gotten even more had it been a more generic tweet and not tied to his country. But the fact that everyone wanted to celebrate with him, just like everyone wants to celebrate you in your moments of peak glory when emotion is at its highest. So how can you be prepared for that moment? Does it mean having a GIF ready to go with a we won GIF, even if it's a championship? Probably not, because a GIF may take a little while to upload, especially if you're in a stadium or an arena or a ballpark full of screaming fans. Is it an image or a video? If you're trying to take a video of the crowd cheering at the end or a big play at the end, that's where you get teamwork going. Assign roles ahead of time. Have a plan. Be prepared. If you have a sponsored tweet or something along those lines, maybe wait on that and capture that highest emotion and get that sharing and share that emotion along with your fans. Have an idea what you're going to type. Unless it's going down to the last minute, it's okay to think about what you're going to say. Even the best, Marv Albert and the like, go into that final moment oftentimes having at least some semblance of what they're going to say, unless it's one of those moments that just comes out of nowhere. In that case, you got to act quickly and, again, go with the motion, go with the flow, and don't try to hold up a video for a while or worry about that snap at the last moment. Make sure someone else is on that stuff so you can hit up the places where the real time is happening the most in sports, and that really is Twitter. And then, of course, you're going to hit your Facebook, you're going to hit your Snapchat, you're going to hit your Instagram, and have everyone working together and capturing in different mediums and different platforms. But really, again, the biggest lesson to take away from this episode's shareable stat, and that's that Usain Bolt had 68,000 retweets and as well as around 115,000 likes from a tweet that he sent mere moments after he won the 100-meter race, and by far his most popular tweet sent in a very long time. And the fact is, he was ready. So how can you be ready? Have a plan, know what you're going to do, and don't waste those precious seconds, because everyone matters. All right, that's episode's shareable stat. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it gets you thinking a little bit and planning for your next big moment. How can you make sure the timing is right? And hope you're enjoying the Olympics as well, as Usain Bolt continues to tweet as fast as he runs, just about. But we're going to have a little fun. We're coming right back with Peter Stringer, and we're going to have some fun and learn a little more and pick his brain a little bit in our Pulling the String segment. All right, that was this episode's shareable stat, and now we are right back with our guest, the Vice President of Digital Media for the Boston Celtics, Peter Stringer. Peter, you kicked ass in your interview. You nailed the three-pointer, knocked down the slam dunk, insert your favorite basketball analogy. Are you now ready for the Pulling the String segment?
I guess I have no choice. Let's do it.
Hell yeah. All right, number one, the sector besides sports that is doing it right in digital and social, and why you think that is.
Interesting. I think I'm a big fan of what the hotel industry does. I like to pay attention to them. Obviously, they're in the experience business. And I think there's a lot of creative companies doing some pretty cool stuff in that space and using social well. The challenge for those guys is always that, anytime something goes wrong, if you're, if you're JetBlue, for instance, in the airline industry, or if you're, you're Marriott or whoever, that if a customer has a bad experience, they're going to be tweeting at you. But, it's really been cool to see all these companies use Twitter as a platform to kind of resolve those issues and kind of do the surprise and delight stuff and make better experiences for their customers.
I love that. Yeah, we get such tunnel vision sometimes in our sports world, even in the sports social community as well, that you don't wake up and notice that there's a lot of other stuff going on in other industries too that's good to learn from. All right, number two. So you've been a website geek for a long time throughout your career. Tell me that the biggest change in websites you lived through in your career.
That's got to be responsive. I mean, you know, it's – well, I guess early on it was standards-based design, right? And so people were kind of building sites with very little rhyme or reason to how they were built and without kind of going down the geek path too far. But there was kind of this web standards movement in the mid-2000s, early to mid-2000s, I suppose, that and it was something that I took a lot of pride in and kind of learning and being up front of that. And, you know, it was something that it took some extra effort to learn and kind of build websites with that methodology. But now, obviously, the mobile device has changed everything. And so it's funny, if I had to build a website today, I'd have to really go back and do some research and kind of, you know, raise my game to be able to actually build a well put together responsive website. There was a time when I knew every single line of code on the Celtics website, had written basically every single line of code on the site. That time has since passed. I've got an excellent developer, Bill Ramos, on my team, who we traded to Phoenix right after his early employment with us, and then I stole him back from McPeak, from Jeremy McPeak out there. I think he kind of knew it was going to happen eventually, but yeah, that's another whole side story. But nonetheless, yeah, responsive design has made everything a much bigger endeavor with regard to building websites.
What they say now, you don't have a mobile strategy, you have a digital strategy for a mobile world. It's wild.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the amount of time people are spending on the phone and just kind of the intimate relationship people have with their phone. You know, people wake up and the first thing they do is look at their phone, and the last thing they look at before they go to bed is their phone. And, you know, you can look at any metric you want. The numbers are staggering. And, you know, they say, I think there was something today that was like one out of every 5 minutes on a mobile phone is spent on Facebook and Instagram, which blew my mind. It's kind of one of those things you don't really think about a lot. Obviously, people are texting constantly and Snapchatting and all these other things. But, yeah, I mean, just, you know, obviously the stats speak for themselves on that platform. Mobile is the way the world works right now.
Oh, no, I'm guilty of that myself. I know that for sure. Number three for you, Peter, your favorite digital or social campaign in your time with the Celtics?
I'd have to say 3-point play, which was something we did, and I've probably talked about years past, but probably not a lot recently. But this is, you know, 2009, and Facebook, everybody at the time was playing Facebook games and Farmville and all that kind of stuff. And we had this growing Facebook audience of about 2 million people at the time and knew nothing about them. And kind of everybody's like, oh, well, what's this Facebook audience for? You know, we've got a database of email people that we can sell directly to, but we have no information on these people in Facebook. And so, to me, that was kind of the impetus of, all right, well, we need to figure out who these people are, and the best way to collect their data would be get them to play a game in exchange for the opportunity to win Celtics tickets. And that first year, you know, we had to invest a significant amount of money to go out and build a Facebook game, which nobody was really doing in the NBA at the time, and something we kind of got slapped on the wrist for, to be honest, by the league. But the following year, it was a best practice from the league. They had me presenting about it at the league meetings, and you know, it was something where we captured about 80,000 names into our database after the first season alone of getting people to play that game, even if all they had to do is really only play it once. And a lot of fans played it every single night and won tickets, and some people got really good at it. But the process of going through and actually building that game that off season and kind of understanding this would be the way to get fans into our database was pretty groundbreaking at the time. And if I can't pat myself on the back for that, but being a little sarcastic, but at the same time, you know, really it was kind of, right, how do we solve this problem and learn about our audience? And people were, you know, how do we monetize Facebook? And that was exactly it. You turn them into ticket buyers. And so, that first year, you know, we got a pretty nice return on our investment with regard to people buying tickets through that app. Not through the app directly, but people who we acquired through the app would then go ahead and buy tickets. We could obviously draw that line back to the people who were, you know, acquired by 3-Point Play and then bought tickets, and that was a direct source of revenue. So that that worked out really nicely for me. That's still probably one of my favorite things that I've done here in my time at the Celtics.
No, that's awesome. I remember coming across that, you know, in my early career and seeing what you guys were doing that with that, and it was mind blowing for me too to see, okay, here's how we can turn social and fan engagement into ROI and getting them into the database. And it's also crazy to think back in those days with the Facebook tab apps and building out those things, and that they used to be incredibly valuable. Now probably people don't even remember those things.
Well, nobody goes to a Facebook page anymore. That's that started happening pretty quickly. You just don't go to people's Facebook page, and that was something that we kind of started realizing. And so we ended up sunsetting that game, I think, after the third year. But we got a great run out of it, and it's like anything else. Things work for a while, but you have to keep your eyes on the prize and understand that the environment changes, user behaviors change, and when that happens, you have to adapt.
It's a changing world, definitely. Evolve or die. Number four for you, Peter. The pro sports team or teams outside the NBA and outside Boston. So no playing off friends or anything like that. That you think does a great job on social, and why?
I still love the Phoenix Suns. Jeremy Peake and his team out there are fantastic. He's obviously a good friend of mine, but I think he's one of the smartest guys in the business. And, you know, I don't think you hear his name enough, honestly. He's done some incredible things with the Suns. He's been with the Suns over 20 years. He started working there in the pro shop and worked his way up to being VP of digital there, which is a pretty awesome story for anybody who, is kind of getting their feet wet in the sports business. And, he's been a guy that I constantly bounce ideas off of. He's, guy I love seeing at the league meetings, because he's one of the smartest ones in the business, and, he's done some great things with them, and I'm always eager to see what he's going to do next.
Jeremy's fantastic, and also a great source of pro wrestling content.
That's right. Yeah, he does a mean Macho Man Randy Savage impression too.
Oh my gosh, he has some time now.
Yeah, all right, get him on the podcast and make him do it.
Oh, it's got to happen now. Number five for you, Peter. The most popular piece of content the Celtics have ever shared on digital or social.
That's a good question. I don't have a year-over-year archive of the most popular content sitting around in front of me, but off the top of my head, there's a few things that stand out. And actually, the one that kind of resonates the most would be Brad Stevens taking the Ice Bucket Challenge, which probably isn't that surprising, right? Because Ice Bucket Challenge a couple of years ago was kind of a monumental moment. But the reason I point to that one is because it changed our whole strategy with regard to Facebook at the time. At the time, we were still putting out links to our website, trying to drive people off of Facebook back to our website. And it was starting not to work very well. But in this, again, the Ice Bucket Challenge, I believe, was 2013 or 14 summer. And so at that time, Brad had emailed me and said, hey, somebody had challenged me to the ice bucket thing. Can you get this out on social and our website and everything? And it was kind of the end of the day on a Thursday. And he'd emailed me the file just directly right off of his phone, right? He had done the video in his backyard and everything, and kind of, rough and dirty. It wasn't something like that my crew had shot or anything. And so I was like, all right, well, we got to get this up on Facebook quickly. And it was actually just a quicker way to do it was just to upload it to Facebook rather than take the time. We had just kind of changed the CMS under the Celtics website that summer, and I wasn't 100% sure of how to upload this stuff pretty quickly. It had been a long time since I was, doing all the daily content updates. And so I was like, well, I can just upload this to Facebook really quickly and we can point fans there. And so uploaded that to Facebook, and, I checked in on it later in the night, and it had done something like 50,000 views within an hour.
Wow.
And it blew my mind. And I was like, whoa, something's going on here. And I'm like, obviously the Ice Bucket Challenge is a big deal, but, It showed to me the power of what native video could be at the time. And so I saw that and I was like, all right, for the next, the next like 2 weeks or so, I'm going to just upload all of our video natively to Facebook and see what the numbers look like. And no surprise, all the numbers were getting, 100,000 views, 80,000 views. And, you know, the light bulb went on. We need to change our strategy because at the end of the day, we're trying to get an audience for people. And yes, this may detract from our website traffic, mm-hmm. but our website traffic had already been dropping year over year because just user behaviors have changed, right? People are not going out to seek out websites. They're getting there because they're linking off of Facebook or Twitter or the places that are spending their time now. And so that whole uploading that video to Facebook changed my whole attitude about it changed my whole outlook on Facebook, and we were really one of the first teams to start uploading content natively. And it changed our entire strategy around it and kind of gave us a much different audience than we were ever getting on video on our website. And so, yeah, that's the piece of content I would point to that, you know, was probably our most successful because it changed our strategy completely.
I love that. Yeah. I can only imagine how many views or Vine loops, you know, Kevin Garnett, Anything's Possible would have these days.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much old school content. When we had Pierce and Garnett on the podium together, those two guys loved doing the post-game presser together. I mean, I don't think Garnett really liked it, but once he got him up there, the two of them were always hilarious. And it was just like, you know, we'd blown a team out by 30 or 40 in some cases, and it would just become a comedy routine. And I wish we had some of those old clips, you know, to be able to put out on social at the time. They would have all blown up, and it would have been, you know, again, we had such an amazing summer that year, bringing Garnett into town and bringing Ray Allen and the whole big three coming together, and the electricity, the energy around that, and going and winning the title the first year was pretty amazing. And you know, we were just starting to do video at that time, but I wish, you know, but Twitter wasn't really a big thing at that point. It just really launched, and mm-hmm. very few people. I think our first tweet came out in, I want to say January of 2008, might have been 2009. I have to go back and look it up, but certainly it's a lot different now than it was at the time. But yeah, no, I mean, I wish if we had native video on Facebook at the time when those press conferences were happening, it would have been amazing.
Oh, I love that. All right, how about you had a podcast at one point called Media Masters. You had a ton of great guests on there. Tell me your most memorable guest from Media Masters.
You know, that's a good question. I think when I go into that, and you know, we did about 15 shows of that, and it's, you know, something, as you well know, there's a lot of time, energy, and effort that mm-hmm. goes into that. And I found pretty quickly that it was too much of an effort for me, even though I put a lot of energy early on into getting guests and trying to get some bigger names on the show. But you know, I really love talking to Bob Ryan, who is a longtime columnist at the mm-hmm. Boston Globe, and kind of talking through his career and how the NBA had changed since when he covered the team and everybody flew commercial and it was a much different era. And the access that he had to players and the friendships that he had with them. And it was just a very different time that when he covered the Celtics in the 70s and 80s versus what it's like today with the five-star hotels and the charter planes and kind of the, you know, velvet rope society that the league is now for the players, especially. It's a different time. But, you know, he was there for all these incredible games throughout the 70s and 80s and you know, saw the team up close back when reporters sat right on the baseline or on the sideline and had the best seat in the house. That's not the case anymore for the media either. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would say, you know, it was fun just to talk through that stuff with him. And I've gotten to know Bob over the years. And so, you know, knew a lot about what he was talking about. And in that case, it was promoting his book about his career and his life and whatnot. But, yeah, that was probably my favorite interview just because of, you know, having had the context of knowing what the league was like. Is, you know, when I got into the you know, NESN and covering the league in the late 90s, that was really when it had just started to change. The Jordan Bulls kind of changed everything with regard to the private planes and all that kind of stuff. And it was, some teams were still adapting at that point, but yeah, the league is very different now than it was when he was covering it. And so it was awesome to have that talk and just kind of go back down memory lane and learn a few things about what the league was like, you know, before I was involved.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, but Bob Ryan's great, and I can only imagine all the great stories he has to tell. So tell me now, going back to more of the social media side, number seven for you, Peter, your biggest social media and sports pet peeves.
I would say it's just people just trying to jump into the conversations that their team has nothing to do with, mm-hmm. Just for the sake of retweets. To me, it's just the teams are trying way too hard to be cool, snarky, funny, and do stuff in the name of engagement that has nothing to do with their brand and doesn't make any sense.
I would definitely agree with that. You see it every single day. There's more examples of that for sure. Number 8 for you. I'm looking forward to this one. The best quote or personality on the Celtics over your years there?
Oof, Kendrick Perkins comes to mind immediately. He was the real talk king of the Celtics locker room back in the Big Three era. And if you wanted to know what was really going on with the team, he would just say whatever was on his mind. That said, Tony Allen was hilarious. And if you ask Leslie Terrell in Memphis, who where Tony's been playing the last couple of years, her and I love to trade Tony Allen stories because the stuff that comes out of his mouth is just amazing and hilarious. And he's one of the quickest witted people you'll ever meet. And just, you know, I can only imagine what he would be like in a Yo Mama Joe competition. He's just hilarious.
Oh, those are some good ones there for sure. All right, I really want to hear this one. It's probably the toughest question you're going to get in this entire podcast. The best food to get in Boston.
Ooh, best food to get in Boston. I would say, let's do it this way. If you're going to get a steak, go to Grill 23. If you're going to go get seafood, go to Atlantic Fish. If you want lobster rolls specifically, you go to Neptune Oyster on Salem Street in the North End. And where else? The chicken fingers at the Garden you always deliver too. I got to be honest with you. I don't get a chance to eat them much because I'm not usually in the seats. But if I go for a concert or something like that, you know, the go-to item at the Garden is the chicken fingers.
We're taking notes now. We got to go and all splurge in Boston for sure.
There you go.
All right, this is gonna be a tough one. So counting out the Celtics, we're not gonna include the NBA in this conversation. More likely to win a championship this year or this following season: the Red Sox, the Patriots, or the Bruins?
No, it's not even close. The Patriots. Even with the suspension, and you know, which again, we could have another podcast on that one. I'm a pretty big Pats guy and Brady guy. So sorry to deflate that question for you, but yeah, I would say definitely the Patriots. Even if they somehow end up going 0-4, I would still say that they've got a legit chance at making the playoffs. And once they get in, you know, I'll put my money on them anytime, you know, figuratively anyway, not into gambling, but, you know, just what that team has done over the last 15 years is pretty spectacular, especially in a league like the NFL where injuries play such a role and personnel is so important. And the Patriots have been pretty ruthless about letting guys go that, you know, whether it's Adam Vinatieri or some of these other guys that they've had that have obviously made big contributions, but they've been pretty much on the mark when they know when guys are getting long in the tooth and can't get rid of them.
Yeah, the Patriots, they do a pretty good job keeping that dynasty together. And you only know that Brady's going to come back and just destroy everybody after that suspension for sure.
Yeah, he'll be on the revenge tour, no question.
Great job in the pull and the string segment, Peter. A lot of fun there, a lot of good insights as well. Now your chance to take over my podcast and tell us your social media all-star to follow. Someone on Twitter, who they are and why they're worth following.
Oh, that's a good one. You know, there's so many choices on that. And I think, you know, the thing about, I guess it depends on what you're looking for. You know, for me, I'm looking for people who kind of bring different things to the table, and this is going to be hilarious. But, one of the people I love following is this guy, Matt Belinsky, who's a Lakers fan. And he's always got an opinion about what the Lakers are doing and has usually pretty been upset with them and been upset with Kobe recently. But I just enjoy reading his takes on the Lakers and the NBA in general and just kind of other political issues and stuff like that. And his stuff just always makes me laugh. I think he's just like a lawyer out in Los Angeles, but I really enjoy reading this guy's tweets. Always cracks me up, and we'll go back and forth sometimes here and there on the old school Lakers and Celtics and that type of stuff. But yeah, that would be my guy. He's kind of way under the radar, obviously, but figured I'd just give a shout out to a random one of my favorite Twitter follows.
I like it. That's what it's all about. And NBA Twitter is probably the best Twitter of all the sports out there, arguably at least.
Yeah, you bet.
And how about yourself, Peter? Where can we find you as well as the Celtics all over digital and social?
Yeah, at Peter Stringer for me, and then obviously at Celtics for us on all of your favorite platforms.
Every single one out there. And obviously the Celtics mobile app is great as well. And check out Celtics.com. It looks a lot different than when Peter first started, as we know now. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Peter. It's been a really great conversation. I know the season is right around the corner, it seems like, and so really appreciate the time today.
Thanks for having me, man.
All right, good luck this year. We're all rooting for you guys.
I hope so. Go Celtics.
Thank you so much again to Peter Stringer, Vice President of Digital Media for the Boston Celtics. Really had a lot of fun talking to him. Learned a lot. Great guy and someone who's really leading the way in sports and being an innovator out there. And so, you know, the NBA is held up as one of the most innovative leagues, and it's people like Peter out there, and even Jerry McPeak with the Suns, who he shouted out, who are doing a great job among other clubs across the league as well, of course, in pushing the envelope. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Again, thanks for listening. Get more content and previous episodes at dsmsports.net. And the podcast is also on iTunes and Stitcher, so you can always subscribe there as well. And if you can follow me on Twitter at njh287. Until next time, I'm Neil Horowitz, and thank you again for listening to the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.